You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings. You look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago. You still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money wasted. Plus, you can use the Smart Savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple App or Google Play Stores.
I always had a private doctor. I didn't think I needed VA care. Then I learned VA is ranked above private care systems nearby and costs less. I'm getting the best care of my life with providers trained to treat veterans. Get what you earn. Visit choose.va.gov.
Not all veterans are eligible for the type or amount of benefits mentioned here.
Dude, that's Smiley Kaufman for 61. Wow.
I'm Smiley Kaufman, and this is The Smiley Show.
What's up, guys?
We are back. We got Charlie Hume, we got Smiley Kaufman joining you here for another episode of The Smiley Show. Happy to have our man Charlie back. Charlie, of course, I know you've been going through a lot with your dad's passing in the last week. Great to have you. We definitely want you to share your thoughts at the end of the episode. And just want to check in. How we doing, my man?
Yeah, no, I tell you what, brought a big smile to my face, a little tear to my eye, which you all did as a tribute to my dad at the end of that last episode. That meant a lot to us. And it's been a heck of a 2025, buddy. We've done a little bit of everything to, you know, watch my dad go through what he's gone through and my own sort of cancer deal. But you know what? We got to just keep on going. And I'm grateful to have you here, you know, as a friend, as a colleague, all these sorts of things. Jackson's support's been huge. So deeply appreciative of you all. And we're just going to keep it going, you know, in 2026. Yeah. So
we've been praying for you guys hard, you and your family. Loved your dad. He's the best. And just too, there's so many people that listen to this podcast to get away from their own daily lives and tune in to golf and us you know, chit-chatting about whatever it might be. It could be golf, life stuff, and we always are here for other people just to get away from their own things that they're going through. So as you listen to the end of this episode, just know that we also are here for you guys. For, you know, it's a community that it's growing slowly but surely, and we love everybody that tunes in. And of course, I know we've had a lot of people reach out to Charlie through this as well, which I certainly know you appreciate.
Now, I was just going to say, you know, it's just a great reminder of what an amazing audience, all listeners, viewers, you all are. Just the amount of people that reached out with thoughts, with prayers, with love, support. You all are the best. We would not be able to do this without your support. So all that meant a ton to both me and my family. So, yeah, I look forward to the end of this episode, sharing some stories, some thoughts, some remembrances of my dad. Of course, many of those in a golf context. But Smiley, we had some big boy golf talk about this week. We had some real... Yeah. 20 of the best players in the world down
December
in Albany.
Golf.
You're still kind of there. You're in Miami right now, right? Is this a Miami hotel room behind you?
All right. It's kind of hard to
the
transition
situation?
to what we just went to where I'm about to say, you know, we're here for everybody. I ain't here for you, American Airlines. I ain't here for you right now.
Oh, that yes. We're slandering American Airlines. Sign me up. We're back.
I have no good words to say for that airline currently as
it's
I watch
bad
it.
Bad airline.
Come flying at the airport hotel here. I had about a 2.5-3 hour layover in Miami, and there was a lot of weather that was kind of rolling through Tampa, Orlando area. So I was always kind of like showing up to Miami thinking that there could be an issue with weather, and literally didn't have any delays whatsoever. But I just had this like feeling in the back of my head that something was going to happen to this flight. And if you've ever been to the Miami airport, which by the way, don't, there is
good match for that as well.
There is a very, very small pocket and it's D60. And if you've ever been down the escalator down to the D60 part of this terminal. There's like 10 different little small gates and about 50 to 100 seats for six potential flights that are going at one time. It is literally what you, when people talk about not wanting to travel and hating travel, it's in this little spot in Miami Airport.
I know that exact spot. It's like a descent into the underworld. It's like that little small semicircle. It's a really steep escalator.
If you know,
my
you
dad
know.
And I, you know, you, my dad and I flew out of that exact spot to go internationally to Scotland. And it's just like, how do we end up with this as like the main hub for significant flights? It makes no sense. And it really is. It's like, here are all the regular human beings enjoying their lives up on the surface. And then there's this subterranean sort of purgatory. It's brutal. It's brutal.
It's literally Stranger Things, the underworld down there. It's while that show is backing at it. It's
very top of you.
I tell you, so we actually bored somewhat on time, and there was the guy boring us, like he was already kind of making me nervous because I'm just thinking like, I'm so ready to be home, and we get on the plane and we push back at a decent time too, and then we start to get onto the, you know, traffic out to get out to like our runway, and we just sit there for like 20 to 30 minutes. And I'm thinking, okay, this is probably weather related. They're just trying to figure out where to travel, get the flight aware up, trying to figure out which way they're going to go. And they're like, all right, guys, sorry, I've been on the phone with air traffic control trying to get us a route. We're good to go. It'll be an hour 37. I'm like, great. And so I kind of doze back off. And then we kind of go forward a little bit. Then we stop again. And then we stop there for about 20, 30 minutes. And that's when I started texting Fran. This is at midnight now. I was like, I don't feel good about this. It's just, there's something funny going on. And then they come on again. They're like, okay, we've had a little thing pop up on our devices, little maintenance thing. It seems like they're going to want to pull us back in, and we're going to have somebody from maintenance come take a look at it. And so I'm thinking, oh gosh, this has all the makings of a canceled flight. Mm-hmm. And so then we get docked, and then we have two people from American Airlines come on the plane, and they're trying to get us to deplane. Meanwhile, the captain and the maintenance people are like, no, we don't need a deplane. And these American Airlines people start yelling at each other outside. They're yelling at the pilots. I'm like, this is an absolute storm that's happening right now between people that wanted us to deplane. The captain's like, no, we don't need to. And eventually, like, the guy who's the mate or the person who works for the airline, who's like the person that got us on the plane, he gets on the things like, everybody needs to get off the plane. We were deplaning. So we get back in, back to the dungeon, and they don't give us an update for an hour. They don't say a word. I don't see the pilots. I don't see the flight attendant. And they don't see anything for an hour. And then they come on and says, we all get a text, flight canceled. Like, everybody, flight has been canceled due to weather. And I was like, due to weather, that is some horse crap, because it was a maintenance issue. And so we get up there, and it wasn't an issue for me because I'm traveling with the company, that my hotel was not a problem. But for everybody else on that flight that now doesn't get a free hotel because it's a weather issue, American Airlines only covers it for a maintenance problem. I was like, that is horse crap, because dude, you literally pulled us off for a maintenance issue. American Airlines, you're lying to your people.
Coming from someone whose then pregnant wife was once kicked off an American Airlines flight with no explanation whatsoever, and then they issued us like a travel voucher for a couple $100 that I made sure they knew I was never, ever going to use again. That's a new low. You've reached a new low. We have American Airlines people arguing outside the plane and then trying to fudge the numbers so that they don't have to pay for hotels, which, you got American Airlines, buddy. I'm really sorry that it had to go that way. And I don't like to flame corporations on this podcast, but this is one I very much enjoy flaming.
The worst scenario that could possibly happen to us as a podcast is if something comes across our desk in the form of a proposal from American Airlines to be a sponsor of this show, and us having to either put our
– prove us wrong.
Or biases aside,
yeah.
And then us try to tell everybody that no, this is the airline of our choice. And I think it would be a hilarious bit.
It'd be a great bit.
If all the people that us doing these reads are just like, all right, you know, like we know they're not serious with this, but we also know that we appreciate it because it pays the bill. So I don't know.
We'll see. It'd be a great redemption arc for us. That's entirely enough airspace, to use a pun for American Airlines on this show, because not only are we going to recap the Hero World Challenge where Smiley was down there broadcasting in the booth on the course, but we have the champion of the Crown Australian Open, Rasmus Nygaard-Petersen, joining us for about 20 minutes, which – although I didn't get to see much of it because it was in the middle of the night. Course looked fantastic. Thrilling finish there. Looking forward to that conversation. And then a few additional big news items we need to catch up on in the world of golf, Smiley. But let's start with Hideki Matsuyama's playoff win. Birdie's the first playoff hole. We replayed 18 to defeat Alex Noren. Big congrats to your fellow Srixon teammate there. And how about Hideki starting the year, winning the century, and closing the year winning the Hero? Nice little booking for Hideki.
Yeah, it was an interesting year for Hideki. First off, heading into the day, if you'd have told me the playoff was anybody other than Sepp Straka and Scottie Scheffler, I would have said, I'll give you maybe one, but not two guys not in the playoffs. So that was shocking, especially even heading into the back nine. I felt like it was going to be one of those two guys to win the golf tournament. And then Hideki holes his iron shot on the 10th hole. It's a shot in from 116. He was 7-under through 8 holes at that point, going from the 3rd to the 10th.
Isn't it nice, too, when Hideki, you know, with all the – when he one hands a finish and it's like, you know, 20 feet or whatever, when Hideki holds a pose, you're like, that's going in the hole.
Yeah. And so I actually talked to Wyndham Clark about this because he played with Hideki, I think, in the first round. And we were talking about how he one hands finishes. Maybe I was asked how Hideki played. He's like, yeah, Hideki made a lot of putts, but you know, you just never know with his iron game. Like there would be times that he would one arm it and we'd go right at it. But he thinks that the only time he takes his hands off of the club is when he slightly mishits it. He said it could still go dead straight. Like that's happens all the time, or it could be going right at the pin. But if it's off center at all, that's when he takes his hands off the club, because he's played with them when he's hit it in the middle and it's gone offline, like right or left, like big misses, and he doesn't take his hands off the club. So I think we've kind of figured out and solved the Hideki mystery of whether he hits good shots or bad shots or
not. He's a contact merchant. He likes to flush it, doesn't care where it goes. I thought it was in the context of this week, Smiley. Hideki was second for the entire week in strokes gain around the green. Only moved off first.
He's stupid. It's stupid.
And the only reason he moved off first was he was second because JJ Spahn chipped in three times on Sunday and leapfrogged him. So that was where your flip-flop was. And obviously we've talked about the raw strokes gain data at this event not mattering a ton because it's a limited field, but you can look at comparisons and, within the field. But
the shot link information is kind of
a little wonky
because how they get it, they have like somebody walking with every group and taking a picture of the golf ball of where it is. And I think they triangulate it from there somehow. So I was kind of always using the data with a grain of salt a little bit, especially like when it came to like proximity, but like scrambling stats, that doesn't change a whole lot. So, but just overall like gains in how much one had versus another, it's kind of wonky that week.
Well, and I'll say too, we're going to talk about turf conditions a little bit later in the show with some sound from Wyndham Clark, but just you just started talking about how stupid Hideki's short game is. Like, what'd you see, you know, from him that was really good in this department this week that helped him win this golf tournament?
I think I wish I would have looked up the stat over the last couple of years to see how many years in a row Hideki's been leading and around the greens statistic. He's well known for how good of an iron player he was. I think if you think about the course of his career and you think about, all right, Hideki Matsuyama, brilliant iron player. Yes, I would tend to agree that is a reason why he's a world-class player. But I think over the last couple of years, the iron game's still been good. He's had injuries he's dealt with, but he is the best pitcher in the golf ball in the game today. It's not even a question in my mind. This guy is unbelievable around the greens. His ability to you know, he could put a golf ball on the top of your head and he could do whatever he wanted with it. And I wouldn't even be concerned at all. I wouldn't be concerned about the top of your head.
Well, and how does he do it? You know, I always kind of refer back to on this show, Jason Duffner coming on and talking about, you know, different guys with, you know, the guys that have weaker grips really do it well. And we've, you know, obviously heard in the past couple of years of just the angle of attack's importance and spin lop and things like that. What is, when you watch Hideki in and around the greens, what does he do that sets him apart?
I see how he sets his right hand in that very beginning. So if you watch here, he's got a lot of set early. And I was talking actually on the range with Tiger about this on Sunday. We were talking about a bunch of guys with some technique stuff, but Hideki was one that came up. I said, this guy's just unbelievable there around the greens. And that's kind of what I said to Tiger. Like, I see that he kind of sets his right hand and is so good at being able to throw the club hat at it. And he said that to him, it looks like he's got a little bit of roll and it kind of goes out a little bit and he chested a ton. Mm. And I thought that was interesting that he has, like, the word that he used was chested. Like, so he's got a lot of, you know, his pivot is not hanging back. It's definitely just tons of, you know, like his big muscles moving. Just about that, or just there's no stall, there's no underneath. It's all just chesty through it.
That's kind of like a Jason Day thing too, right? Where the arms are very quiet or almost dead, and it's a lot of just moving through the ball with the chest.
Yes and no. When you think about Jason Day, I would put him much more in like the Steve Stricker category. Right. Two guys that I think are the best basic chippers in the game, in the world. If you're going to look at a baseline of if we're looking at a green that has a pin in the back or a pin in the middle, and you're just sitting on the fringe with no slope, I'm taking Jason Day and Steven Stricker's motion every single time because of the repeatability of the pattern. There's no hinge. It's very, very easy to repeat time after time. Now, I would say that Hideki, I think, can toe the line of being able to be very, very good at basic pitches and really good at hard pitches too. Meanwhile, like if you want to go on this other side of the coin, where who would be like one of the best at the really, really hard shots, like Phil Mickelson.
Yeah.
Like he's really good at both, but you would put him in that category, like Scottie Scheffler, Jordan Spieth, these guys over here that can spin it a ton. They're a lot steeper. They're much more in the Joe Mayo bucket. Where like Jason Day, Steve Stricker, although you can, maybe it's, you know, how you measure something. Like I'm sure that Jason Day and Steve Stricker have some element of down. If we're going to like measure the VSP or whatever it's called. So I don't want to be like too incorrect when talking about all this chipping stuff, but I would say that they would be much more on the shallow of thinking of how they probably consider how they pitch. Now they might set up steep, but their motion and how they might think is much more on the shallow end. Where we get back to Hideki, I think he kind of blends both really well. Mm. Like I think he's got the ability to kind of get steeper on it when he wants to and be able to throw the club and not necessarily be too diggy in the ground. Where meanwhile, he also is really good at the basic stuff too, to where it doesn't appear to me like where he's very diggy and quite as steep and as drivey as like a Phil, a Scotty, or a Jordan. So I just think it's unbelievable what he's able to do. And then his bunker game is just phenomenal, like phenomenal.
That, I find that so interesting. It's almost like if you're boiling it down to the amateur player, if you're trying to get better at chipping, at pitching the golf ball, go watch Jason Day and Steve Stricker. Like you're not going to set them up with Phil Mickelson videos and try to figure that out. But it is so interesting to understand that in the context of Hideki, of just all the different ways he can create around the green, and the stats bear that out. And I think just it is interesting looking at his year where he wins to start the year. But then the rest of the season, no top tens the rest of the PGA Tour season, misses the cut at the Players Championship and the PGA Championship. But now we're looking at following this week, he's now 17th in the OWGR and he's 18th in the Data Golf rankings. What is like the story of 2025 for Hideki Matsuyama in your opinion? I don't know if I want to have you give him like a report card grade, but like how are you looking back at this year for him and assessing it?
He never really got into contention a whole lot besides his wins, you know?
Yeah.
It was, I would say, close but no cigar, but it was really just you know, if you look at his results, he finished in the at 15th to 25th 12 times last year, which is, I would love to have. That's a great paycheck every single week. But I think Hideki's standards are that his ceiling is as high, maybe not quite as high as a Scotty, but it's a top 10 player of the world, no doubt, when he's got his good stuff and can win any golf tournament. He's fearless. He's a guy that when you're playing him on Sunday and you're competing with him one-on-one, whether he's in the group in front of you or not, you know when he's on that he's not backing down. He's done it before. He shot 62 at the Genesis Invitational in 2024 when Patrick Cantlay appeared to be, you know, having a runaway potential win when he was up by six on Hideki.
I remember that was the Cantlay Xander final round pairing, right? And that was when you and I were texting like on the 14th or 15th hole, like, hey, should we just start recording now? This
dude, silly. Hideki housed this thing before it was, you know, I think he was on 15. I was like, this thing's over. just the fact that 9-under at Riviera is stupid. You know, 62 out of that car.
That back nine, right? Like his total prox was like, you know, combined was like 20 feet. He was making everything
too. And that's what we saw on Sunday too. So Hideki has that capability of absolutely just getting in fuego with the putter. He's, I think, a very, very hot and cold putter. When it's on, it is so good. But when it's off, it's like, oh, man, he's not as good inside of 6 feet. Doesn't clean things up. Three putts. Uncomfortable.
Can you help me connect that? Let me ask you this question. Do you find it weird that a guy that is so good as a pitcher of the golf ball can get so streaky with the putter, given that they can both be feel-related items?
He is the biggest tinkerer in the world.
Yes.
This guy.
This is my people.
This guy can't help himself. I remember this at the Century. He was warming up with another putter on Sunday when he had like a 5-shot lead. And I'm just like, this guy is relentless with trying new stuff.
Oh, I love it.
He's always like taking note of what other people have. He has 10 different shafts. I remember out before the final round at the FedEx St. Jude, the one he ended up winning last year. He's got all these different shafts lined up on before his final round on Sunday. I'm like, this guy's unbelievable. And Fax actually talked to Hideki on the range. This was before the Saturday round. And Hideki speaks English kind of. In fact, I think just expected that he'd be able to understand everything he's trying to say. And so Fax gets up there and he's talking to him. He says, Hideki, I played with Scotty Cameron the other day. And Scotty told me that he thinks that you have close to 400 Scotty Cameron putters. Is that true? And Hideki, I don't even know if he said yes or no, but just the fact that that's a story and that's a possibility was awesome. I just said, that's a great question. We're gonna take that as a yes. And all the putter collectors, putter tinkerers, rejoice, because Hideki is one of us, and he is the leader, the crown leader of the putting collections, if you will.
Well, and also the collection of stories we've now assembled on this show related to Hideki Matsuyama is far and away our best collection of stories. Like, I think this is the idea we need to workshop. Somebody at IHOP reach out to us, because we need to do pancakes and putting. We need to get
what a scoop that was, by the way.
IHOP's unbelievable. Like, if we can just get a putting green and all of Hideki's putters out there, and then we just eat one pancake and then we go in and use a different putter. Yeah. Like that would do gangbuster numbers on social.
Hold on. For the people that aren't familiar with the IHOP story.
Please, yes.
If you're new to the show, if you're a first-time listener, many people that have listened to the show still bring this up every now and then with Hideki. Just if we start randomly talking about it, it's like, oh, IHOP. Well, I have found out last season that Hideki is – I don't know if addicted is the right word, because that's a strong word. But
this is 2024 FedEx Cup playoffs, right? This is end of the year, right? Yeah.
He's a big advocate of eating IHOP a lot. And he's not afraid to go and quadruple stack pancakes before any round. And so I'm thinking, like, really? Like, is he that into it? And the story that I heard is that he books hotels based off of where the IHOPs are. And I just thought that was awesome. You know, if you're somebody that just loves getting a little you know, pancakes going before the round. Hideki's got to be a new guy you cheer for. But still, just bizarre. I mean, Hideki, a lot of times, will be staying where we're staying, which is not necessarily where, like, most of the guys are staying. But I think it has everything to do with where the IHOP is, which I think you have to appreciate.
If I and you should just go back and on our playlist and find our shows from the FedEx Cup Championship or the FedEx Cup playoffs. I want to say it was the BMW Championship show and the Tour Championship show where it was like you had back to back scoops. I think in the BMW it was you just learned of this hotel booking thing, and then I believe in the Tour Championship it was that you had gotten in the elevator with his like coach or translator, and he had a big old bag.
He's got two massive plastic bags with the just to go boxes stacked up, big gulps of the clear IHOP.
I love it, Hideki, so much.
Extra large, like Coke.
So good.
I could believe it.
Pancakes and putters. Let's make it happen, IHOP.
You really want to be better with your finances. You try to put money away in savings, you look for deals. You wrote out a budget once a long time ago, yet you still overdraft from time to time and you still have debt. The truth is, managing money is not easy, but Rocket Money can help. Rocket Money shows you exactly what you're spending every month. From there, the app helps you make a budget that meets your financial goals. The app even gives you real-time alerts when you're about to go over your budget so you don't spend too much. With Rocket Money, you can also see all of your subscriptions at a glance and cancel the ones you don't want right from the app. Rocket Money can even try to get you a refund for some of the money you wasted. Plus, you can use the smart savings feature to start putting more money away. Rocket Money analyzes your accounts to determine the optimal time to stow away cash without going over your budget. Our members report that the Rocket Money app saved them more than $700 a year. Getting better with money doesn't have to be a pipe dream. Rocket Money can make it a reality. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
I as much as I love just do a deep dive on Hideki's many interesting hobbies, we also got to talk about the guy he played against in this playoff. And dude, what a wild 2025 for Alex Noren. Right, because he doesn't return from injury. It was a hip injury in the offseason. Is that correct, or was it something different? He got
something on the broadcast said it was a hamstring, and I thought it was hip too.
Whatever it was, he had an extended absence at the end of 2024, and this first tournament he played again was the Truist, the one they played at Philly Cricket in May. Misses three cuts and his first seven starts back. Then he ties for seventh at the 3M, ties for third at the Wyndham, but misses the FedEx Cup playoffs. Then he goes and wins two of his next three starts on the DP World Tour, the Betfred British Masters and the BMW PGA Championship. A lot of people were arguing he should have been playing for Europe at Bethpage Black instead of being an assistant captain.
Him and Keegan both.
He did not retain his PGA Tour card through the top 100 points list through top 100 on the FedEx Cup points list, but he did re-earn his PGA Tour card for this next season via finishing top 10, not otherwise exempt on the DP World Tour.
He's still on a medical though.
He's still on a medical as well, but that's a category I saw him in. I guess he might've been in the medical category as well, but either way, he would have earned it that way. He is now 12th in the OWGR and 17th in the data golf rankings. I guess when I came into this discussion, Smiley, I was thinking, like, is a now fully healthy Alex Noren a good sleeper pick to pick off some big wins in 2026? But I don't even know if we can call him a sleeper anymore.
No, you can't. You can't. He's playing some of the best golf of anybody in the world right now. And I can tell you that I got paired with Alex Noren at Torrey Pines one year, and he actually finished second at the end of that week. And so I played the North Course, the South Course with him on Thursday and Friday. And I think he's probably top five, one of the most impressive players I've ever played with. Like, he's definitely up there in that category. If not in the top five, it's definitely close, because his ability to shape the ball both ways when he's got this rehearsal that he does every single time where it feels like he can never, ever hit something that would ever go right to left. And he
can you explain that? Ways. That's a question. Like, could you just explain what he's trying to do for people home who are watching him do this and saying, what on earth is that all about?
I asked him before the round yesterday, because I was kind of thinking to myself, could this help me? Could I do this? And would it help my golf game? So it helps him with his tilts is what he was talking about. His caddy was really explaining it, that, he sometimes will get in too much of a tilt this way in the downswing. So this whole feeling is just an over exaggeration of the feeling that he has to have, because if anything, he would get too much this way. So it helps him get more tilted here and then also more tilted that way. So I obviously, when you watch that, you don't feel like that's what's going on, because he's got, you know, it just feels like he's working on getting his path 70 to the left when he's doing it. Yeah. And like trying to hold the face like crazy, and just getting those hands in there, like that right arm in there bent. So he's obviously a rotator, and maintains his tilts really well, but it's a really impressive golf swing. Watching his flights, it's the trajectory of in which way he hits a golf ball, shapes it great. And honestly too, his demeanor I think is interesting, because I talked to him, this is at the Pro-Am dinner party, which we need to talk about my Pro-Am experience, which interesting and fun.
I didn't get any tea announced videos this year, which I was a little bit sad about.
I have it. Post it. So we, I'm like, hey Alex, I'm in the booth this week. Got anything that'd be interesting for the broadcast? And he's like, nah, I got nothing. And I was like, thanks, man. And it's like, so you're telling me you literally have nothing, like all the good golf that you've played, there's nothing that has come up. So you know what? I've just been doing the same things. I stick to my processes, and I just go and just focus on the job at hand and see where it puts me. I'm like, and I was like, dude, that's too simple. Can you not make it more complicated than this? Can you not tell me it's like a little bit more than that? But it's what your demeanor and your mindset has to be as a professional athlete. It can't ever be too complicated, and you can't ever make it feel like it's something that it's more than what it is. And I think Alex Noren's demeanor was, I thought, just so interesting. And then after I had that conversation with them, I'm like, Alex Noren might win this week. And by the way, shout out to Rick Gaiman. If you listened to the podcast with him last week, which is a fun, interesting deep dive into statistics, data, and analytics, heading into the Hero World Challenge, he said, I think Alex Noren's live this week. And after talking with him, I was like, man, this is kind of like matching up the data gut and the stats and intel. So not surprised to see him have a good week.
Yeah, heck of a call from Rick. And by the way, yeah, definitely worth a re-listen of that episode. While I was out with the family, I was catching up on that one. I was like, man, just so much good insight here and things to kind of think about if you want to really get nerdy about not only the data side of the game of golf, but I thought some stuff we'll talk about in a little bit here with Sepp Straka about, you know, shot shape and the way that's changed on tour. He's doing a lot of really cool charting of data to help people understand the game better.
Who is? Oh, Rick.
Rick Gaiman, yeah.
I thought you said Sepp was. I was like, what?
No. He could be.
Just those Diet Cokes and cheering for the Georgia Bulldogs, man. What are you talking about?
I want to get to Rasmus here, the winner of the Australian Open, but a couple of quick hitters on both Scotty and Sepp, who, of course, were in that final group but fell off the pace a little bit near the end. And so it is the one-year anniversary of Scotty's switch to the claw putting grip that won him the 2024 Hero World Challenge. I thought it was kind of cool going back to look at some stats that since switching to the claw. Like, I remember the first year we did that pod, you know, large swaths of 2023 and 2024 as well. You're just looking at a sea of red in the strokes gained putting column for Scotty. He has only had three negative strokes gained putting performances since switching to the claw, which blows my mind that it was that much of a light bulb. And only one of those was more than a shot negative given away to the field at the 2025 Arnold Palmer Invitational. The other two, the Charles Schwab and the Scottish Open, were like 0.2 of a shot, 0.3 of a shot. So it is insane how much he's changed here. This week, second strokes gained putting. I just want to know what report card grade are you giving Scotty for the year of putting with the claw?
Oh, dude, A+. From where he was to where he is now, you have to give not only Scotty credit, but his putting instructor, Phil Kenyon, a ton of credit too. Implementing it at the right time in the offseason before the Hero this past year and really just seeing success right away. I think Scotty didn't have any clarity, I think, in what he was trying to do with his putting. He was changing his feels a lot, looking, searching for whatever the technical feel was to, you know, keep his mind at ease to where he felt comfortable when he's putting. And I think anybody that's listening that's gone through a putting spell where they're not comfortable and nothing doesn't look right and they're thinking about technique, you're not going to be that great at putting either, you know, and Scotty Scheffler wasn't for a couple of years, and he was chasing it. The ball wasn't getting started on line. And what he's been able to achieve this past year, which I think the goal was to get better inside of 10 feet. You go look at his stats. He was, I believe, heading into this past season, I think he was outside the top 125 inside of 10 feet. And he enters, you know, I guess finishes the season off right around 30th inside of 10 feet. And then you go 4 to 8 feet. He was right around 20th to 25th in that category. He was outside of 150 in that category the year before. And these are seasons in which Scotty won a bunch a couple years ago. So we're just talking about how much he improved from one year to the next. And it goes back to a conversation that comes to my head that I had with Phil Kenyon. We were talking about Scotty and just what he was working on with his putting and just technically what he was trying to do. And it was initially about this, but he made a comment about Justin Rose and how, I guess, earlier in his career, maybe before he had gotten to Phil Kenyon, was something that Justin was. You know, he was a good putter. He had his moments. He was a little kind of inconsistent at times, but he's kind of played it. He's improved himself to where he's actually, you know, I think considered to be one of the better putters in the world. And it made me think about what happens if that happens to Scotty. And I think he actually believed that Scotty could do it too. He said he's an incredible green reader. He's a somebody that has a ton of feel. He's a really good lag putter. If his technique and his mechanics match up with his creative side in which he plays the game, in which he's such a visual player, he has such good touch and feel. If he's able to blend those mechanics in and the stroke consistency, there's no reason why Scotty can't be a top 10 putter in the world. And I walked away with that conversation thinking that would be bad for everybody else.
Yes. And it has been in a lot of ways. I mean, it's amazing, you know, just the year that's passed to see just the way. It was funny that I think that the category he was most efficient in this week was the one where most everybody struggled was around the green. You know, I guess I shouldn't say most everyone because Hideki and JJ Spahn seem to do a pretty good job there. But you know, I think that the belief in from the instructor side, from Phil Kenyon, and then Scotty's willingness to kind of implement that at the right time. I mean, it feels like it can only get better. It's unbelievable.
Just think about it. Just think if you're Phil Kenyon, you're the coach of Scotty Scheffler.
Mm-hmm.
Wouldn't you kind of lose sleep over that idea of like, hey,
totally.
Scotty, what do you think about going to the claw grip? Because like, what do you not want to do if you're the coach of Scotty Scheffler? Screw him up. Or get fired. Like, that's a pretty dang good paycheck coming in week to week. I mean, just the amount of things you're able to do is just being the coach of this guy. I'm not saying that's what, you know, makes these guys tick, whether they make changes or not, because I think coaching is very, very challenging, especially for these top players in the world on if you're going to make a suggestion for change, it needs to be something that the player understands and can work long term.
I mean, you're looking at the guy who wanted Scotty to show up to the President's Cup with a broomstick with like no announcement. So I don't think I'm qualified on this topic to give a ton of insight other than just tinker with the putters for fun. I have a quick one on Sepp, the other participant in that final group, that connects back to the conversation you had with Rick Gehman. Because just listening to the broadcast, obviously watching Sepp play, and Rick looking at data visualizations and guys' preferred shot shapes. And obviously the cut is the preferred shot shape on tour, so much so that the draw is almost extinct as a go-to shot shape for most guys. And I was just curious from your perspective, who can you think of notably that play a draw predominantly? Like, I feel like Sepp Straka is, of course, one. Rory McIlroy would be one. Like Russell Henley, Bryson DeChambeau. Who's on your list of guys that play? Okay, where am I wrong? And who are the guys that you say, hey, watch this guy week in, week out, and he's going to work the ball right to left predominantly. And he's a member of a dying breed.
Russell hits it pretty straight. He doesn't really curve it a whole lot. Chris Kirk, he hits slingers. Okay. Robert McIntyre, actually, being a lefty, he works it left to right a lot. Especially you see a lot of times with irons, you see guys being able to work it both ways, and sometimes patterns for certain guys for that typical, or you know, for that particular week or that month, that they just are hitting more draws than they are fades. I think it's easier to turn something over with irons too. It's a shorter club. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, sometimes a lot of times required for getting into certain areas of the green. So I think it's almost more surprising to see guys hit one particular shot. Like if they're just hitting fades with irons,
mm-hmm.
I don't see that a ton. You know, that's the only, like Chris Goddard, it was a good example Rick Gamen gave. It's like, that is the only shot he has, just fade, 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 fade. Like JJ Spahn, yes, he hits a lot of fades, but he also hits it right to left too with his irons.
Mm.
Now, I don't ever see Sepp hitting many fades with his irons.
Right.
So there are a lot of guys that will just kind of stick to just that one shot pattern and just kind of maybe change trajectories here and there. Like Kenny Perry, good example of the guy who just hit draws and even high draws. That's how he played the game. But for the majority part, like a lot of players are trying to hit different trajectories in different windows. And even Scottie Scheffler, like, yes, his predominant pattern is a fade, but he can work it right to left when he needs to, which I think is important with irons. But the driver is where I think you see a lot of guys. It's just hard to turn over a driver these days consistently. And it's, I think, harder to fit those guys, like the Lucas Glovers, the Sepp Strakas, the Chris Kirks. Like these heads, the way they're built now, Zach Johnson, I think they are the hardest to fit. If you go talk to any equipment manufacturer, somebody who's on the ground a lot, these new heads and the way they're built, it just...
They're fade biased, right? They're all kind of fade biased.
And those are the ones that they're like, God, we can't find a right head for this guy. And they find one and then they crack that one. And it's never quite right because they have to have spin, you know, like you got to have spin with these draws. Like you don't want something that's not spinning a ton because it's ugly looking. You know, you can get away with a flat spinny fade, but it's gross when it's a draw because that can get you some weird shots to spit, because you to draw it, really, you definitely need some spin.
Smiley, last one on the hero on the way out. I'm going to tee this up with Wyndham Clark's quote earlier in the week. He was asked about the chipping in the short game around here, and his response, which is now famous on the golf social media, the interwebs. Do you want the politically correct answer? It's not in good shape. You're always chipping into the grain. There's a lot of chips that are up and over, so you have to chip up. You're coming from really bad lies in Bermuda, and you have to hit it up. There's just very little margin for error. I would encourage anyone who wants to be harsh on Wyndham to go watch the video. I think it was said in a very honest and genuine sense. There was no real like malice intent there. The reason why I want to bring this up is because you played in the Pro-Am down there earlier in the week, and you encountered some of these lies as part of your journey through that round. So let's get the full week up.
That's
that a good way to frame? So walk us through how it went there and whether or not you encountered some of these lies that Wyndham referenced earlier in the week.
I think I need to stop playing golf in December. I think it's the first thing that I've realized, because I think I've played the Floridian Pro member a couple of years, played this Pro-Am, and I am just not sharp whatsoever. And I had a great time with my Shamble group, by the way. It was incredible. Shout out to the boys up at Trout National, excuse me.
That's that new one that Tiger and Mike Trout built, right?
I played with Mike's brother Tyler. Also played with one of I think he's maybe like some form of I don't think GM is the right title that he had, but Mike's another member out at Trout National as well. Played with him and then two other guys from Liberty National, Nick and John. We had a great time, and luckily enough, these guys were hitting fairways, and I just played a shamble with these guys pretty much. So it was basically a scramble from there, which that's where I shine. Like, give me in the fairway. Let me go from there. So we played well, and I said I was going to shotgun a water every single time we made birdie because they had waters out there in a can. And I was like, oh, I didn't think we were going to play that good. And meanwhile, we shot 11 under on the front nine. I was like, okay, that's too many waters to shotgun, guys. But anyways, the challenge is it's difficult around the greens. It's because yes, every shot for the most part is chipping into the green. It's because the greens are raised. It's because you have to get height. And when you have into the green chip shots, really the only way to play them is you have to get ball first. And to get ball first, for the most part, you got to get a little steeper on it. And so it's really hard to get height and spin. You can get spin, but it just comes out lower. And so when you think about things that are coming out lower, well, I just told you that the greens are raised. So you have to fly it. You have to get it higher up in the air. So you don't want it to be flying into these hills. And it's just, it's really challenging. So guys were trying to figure out all week, how do I fly something onto the green with enough spin to keep it near the hole? Or, you know, just the challenge of flying something into a hill with spin and trying to manage that first bounce. And I think you saw guys do it really well. You saw some guys struggle with it. But for the most part, I think the fairways and around the green surrounds have gotten better, but they've definitely struggled over the years. I mean, for the last decade, getting that Bermuda grass to be, you know, I would say similar to what these guys see week in and week out with Bermuda.
It just looked like they're the ground repair areas around the greens and runoffs. It's weird. I don't know how to feel about that.
In September and October, they got 40 inches of rain in like a span of like six, 8 weeks. So that it was just an absurd amount of rain during the rainy season. And I'm not sure if it's just the time of the year, the practices that they might use. So I don't know. It's challenging, but everybody has the same thing they're working with. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a different wrinkle and a different type of protection to the golf course than maybe that these guys don't have to deal with week in and week out. Cause I don't want to see I like to see these guys have to challenge themselves and have to play different shots. So if it's turf conditions, which is the reason why we get to see a little bit more creativity, I'm not against it as a viewer.
That's what, you know, a lot of people were you know, moaning about, but that's not the right word to use there. I'd say like that there was a lot of chatter about this and like the venue itself. And I was initially thinking, you know, yeah, this is kind of, it's a tough scene for whether or not it's an official PGA Tour event or not, it's a tough scene. But then the more I started to think about it and just watching through the week, it's like, there are guys who are figuring this out. Like, look at what Hideki did all week long. Look what JJ Spahn did on Sunday. It's like guys are figuring this thing out. So if it calls for a little more creativity in those situations and to execute a certain type of shot, that's a cool thing to see on display in a PGA Tour setting. So
You saw some good technique, but I got to get back to the drawing board with the golf game. All good. We'll figure it out. But it's fun here. World challenge. So it's always a fun one to work.
I on that topic on the way out, I got to give a shout out to a scramble I played recently with the North Carolina men's golf team. One of my teammates, Ryan Burnett, medalist at second stage qualifying for PGA Tour School in the Valdosta location. Go. How about that?
I didn't like how that went down though.
Yeah. It's,
we hadn't talked about this. I don't like how you have got to guarantee four rounds for Q School. I do not care what the contracts say. That is something that needs to be addressed by the tour, because whether it's when you think about how the Q School days work, for the most part, they go Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and then it doesn't stretch into Saturday because either they don't have those days paid. Like, they need to find like an amendment in these contracts to pay additional dollars for that Saturday or that Sunday. You can't just have this cut and, you know, black and white contract where you can't extend into Saturday, because it's,
you're talking about the contract with the venue, correct? Like, yes, the days the you own. Yes.
They're not going to give up their weekend unless they're getting paid for it. Now, maybe a lot of these clubs wouldn't agree to that possibility of giving up their course on a Saturday, but there's just too much on the line. Agreed. There's too much on the line. You have the TPC network at your disposal. Figure out a way to guarantee that you have an extra day or two on the back end to give these guys an opportunity to have that last round. It stinks. It's absolutely, there's too much money that these guys are spending at Q School to go play a Sunday round and the leaders don't get through eight holes and it's deemed not even a round that they can go and finish. What is this? I hate that.
I agree completely. Like, you know, when Charlie went out to play a little old, you know, Carolina's Golf Association mid-am qualifier a couple months ago, and it rained all morning long, and they changed five holes from par fives to par threes, whatever it was. That's understandable. If this is a competition that's leading towards the handing out of PGA Tour cars, we got to find a way to get to make every stage of that fully legitimate. And so I agree with you.
Heartbroken for him.
Yeah. But hey, shout out to Ryan Burnett. So good luck this next weekend.
Yeah.
Q School coming up. So, all right, Smiley, we're running short on time. We got so much to cover this week, but the next person that we're going to hear from on this show, Rasmus Nygaard Pedersen, the champion of the Crown Australian Open, a recipient of a 2026 PGA Tour card via his finish on the DP World Tour race to Dubai, and someone who is heavily jet lagged right off the plane, right into your DMs, and right onto the show. So we're looking forward to hearing from him on a thriller of a finish. He wins this thing on the last hole in essentially a match play scenario with Cam Smith. So without further ado, Smiley, let's hear a conversation here with Rasmus Nygaard Pedersen.
All right, guys, welcome back. We got a great guest on today. I was sitting here thinking, how can we get somebody on to talk about what the Aussie Open was this week, which was an incredible venue, Royal Melbourne. Sitting here going through, looking at journalists, looking through the players. And I was like, hold on, let's see if Rasmus is around. And just randomly shot out of the dark, sent Rasmus Nygaard Pedersen a random DM maybe an hour ago, and quickly gets back. Here he is on the show today. Rasmus, can you just tell us how you're feeling? I know you're back in Denmark now, coming off of a long flight. Where are the emotions after what was an incredible week at the Aussie Open? And by the way, congratulations.
Yeah, thank you. I'm still kind of riding the high, to be honest. It's one of those things. I don't feel like it's quite sunken in yet, because, you know, even after I got done with all the media stuff and all that stuff that comes with winning, like, it was a pretty quick turnaround to go ahead and just get to the airport to catch my flight going home. And yeah.
Was it just like a red eye out of there or what?
Yeah. I think the flight left at like 11:30, but I get to see, I mean, it's like a 14, I flew through Doha. So it's like a 14-hour flight there and then a 7-hour flight from there. So I'm running on fumes now. I can definitely feeling all the time and feeling the jet lag, but just so happy that I was able to get across the line yesterday.
Well, take us through the week. So heading into the Aussie Open, I think a lot of people have been excited about this event being held at Royal Melbourne, one of the most famous golf courses in the world. I think a lot of American viewers are used, or I guess their latest memories of Royal Melbourne was when they had the President's Cup, when Tiger Woods was the playing captain there. But before that, I mean, it's not something that we get to see on TV very often. What were your expectations of Royal Melbourne? And have you played much golf on the sand belt before this year?
No, so I played the Australian Open last year. That was my first time to Australia, period. And we got a fair bit of rain there, and I think they were doing it as a mixed event, so they were going to keep it slightly softer than they would like just because of the women, and then we got rain as well. But I knew this year, I've kind of circled it on the calendar all year, like just as that little, you know, obviously the DP World Tour season ended a couple of weeks ago. So now it's the brand new season starting up, but I've been looking forward to the event as soon as I saw it was at Royal Melbourne, because obviously I know the history there. It's like I've watched, again, President's Cup and tournaments being played there, and just wanted to get in on the action. But I think going into the week, I was expecting it to be really firm, really fast, and just kind of one of those spots where you can get yourself in trouble pretty quickly. And it certainly lived up to that. It was an incredible week. Not only obviously because of the result, but also just as a whole, like the fans, the amount of fans. I think they broke, someone told me yesterday, I think they had 113,000 spectators out there throughout the week, with 30,000 over both Saturday and Sunday. So it was absolutely wild.
Did it feel like that many people too? I've never been on property. Do these holes kind of frame perfectly to have, you know, a good viewing experience if you were a spectator?
Yeah, I mean, there were probably 5, 10 deep on, like, especially obviously yesterday in the final group, they were like 5, 10 deep on every side of the fairway, the whole way up along the hole and around the greens. Obviously play with Cam Smith, Smith as well. So I probably wasn't the most popular winner ever. The fans have been great to me all week, but I could kind of feel as we got closer towards the end yesterday that it was getting a little bit dicey out there. But again, that's what to be expecting. And it's a great experience.
Did it feel like an away game?
No, yeah, it definitely felt like an away game at the end there. I did hear as my second shot on 18 was going right toward, I thought it was going to be in the bunker, to be honest, but I heard him cheering up by the green, like probably not because it caught a piece of the green. I was like, probably not in the great spot, but it's all good. I mean, it's not like they weren't clapping or cheering or whatever. I'd do something good, but obviously the roar on 17 when Cam made that 18 footer up the hill to stay tied in the lead, it was it got pretty loud there, I'd say.
All right, walk me through the chip shot at the 18th hole. You walk up to the green, you see it's not in the bunker, and it didn't look like it was necessarily a place that you could potentially get it inside of 10 feet without landing in it in some type of fringe, which was looked to be non-existent. What was your thoughts on the lie and really just what was going through your brain on what type of shot that you had in front of you?
Well, yeah. So walking up there again, I thought walking up there, so I couldn't quite see that it actually hadn't gone in the bunker. I thought it was going to be in the bunker. And I mean, the bunker there is still not a great spot to be, but it's doable. Like you can be aggressive with your landing spot and you can get it close. But I got up there and I saw I was in the rough. I'm like, oh gosh. I mean, the lie could have been worse, but it wasn't great. It wasn't one that was sitting up so I could like kind of get under it. So I kind of had to just chop down on it knowing that I wasn't going to get any spin. No. So, I mean, even if I try to land it, you know, a foot on the green, it's still going 10, 15 feet past. So it's one of those, you're just trying to land it, you know, a step or two on the green and you kind of take what you get from there. And then like, that's one of the cool features with sandbelt courses. Like, as you said, like there's literally no fringe. It goes straight from green into the bunkers.
It's crazy, so man.
There's not, there's no cushion. It's you're either on the green or you're in a bad spot. So, you know, honestly thought I executed that little chip shot, flop shot, whatever you want to call it, as pretty much as good as I could have done. I mean, I think I could probably get it to a similar spot, maybe, I don't know, three, four times out of 10, but then the other six are going to be either in the bunker in front of me or just way long.
And before we get to the putt, Rasmus, I was actually sitting there on Thursday at the Hero World Challenge, and Jordan Spieth and I are sitting there on his condo couch watching the Aussie Open, and he had played there a couple different times, and he said to me, he said, these greens, you know, potentially could be the fastest greens in the world is the way he described them. He said, no joke, they can legitimately be 16 on the stimp meter in some places. And for somebody who hasn't been there and hasn't played this golf course, it was hard for me to fathom. And so when I started to see some different camera angles with some different handhelds that they were using, I was starting to see the amount of slope around these greens. And I'm thinking, gosh, this kind of reminds me of Augusta a little bit in some places. Is this true? Is what Jordan was talking about with these greens, how fast they were and how much break they could potentially have? Was that something that was a factor in the entire week?
Yeah, well, so I think it actually might be, don't quote me on this, but I think it might be the same designer that did Augusta as well. And you can certainly see similarities around some of the green complexes. Like there's hardly any rough around the greens. It's all just kind of runoff areas. They were by far the fastest on the Sunday. They had to be a little bit conservative early in the week because we had on the Thursday, we had like a quite a strong, hot northerly breeze down there, which, I mean, it was probably, I don't know, high 80s, 90 and blowing 30 to 40. So like it's really drying out. So they had to be really conservative with, they couldn't cut them in the morning just to make sure we could get play throughout the day. And then my guess is on the Friday, they would have to, because the forecast on Friday was good, but they probably had to pull the course back a little bit. But I think, I mean, by the weekend, they were still really fast. And the greens, there's a couple of them. Obviously, they call it the composite course because there's two 18-hole courses at Royal Melbourne. But especially like there's the sixth screen we're playing there. There might only be, like it's quite a big green. I think it's probably 35 deep and 25, 30 wide. But there might only be, there's two sections basically on the green where you're going to have a pin, and those sections are maybe 10 feet by 10 feet. And the rest of the green is just unusable. So it's one of those courses where you have to be so precise. I mean, don't quite getting in that area, you can look absolutely terrible.
Think about the last time you had to cancel a subscription. There's probably some waiting on hold, some guessing at your password, some mind-numbing small talk, and maybe after all that, you still weren't able to cancel it. Good news. It doesn't have to be this way. Thanks to Rocket Money. Rocket Money tracks, manages, and can cancel your subscriptions for you. When you connect your accounts, you'll see a complete picture of all your reoccurring subscriptions all in one place. Rocket Money organizes your subscriptions by due date and notifies you when something's coming up, so you'll never be caught off guard when you get charged. If you see a subscription you want to cancel, Rocket Money simplifies the process. Instead of waiting on hold for an hour, you can cancel it right from the app. Rocket Money will even try to get you a refund for the money you spent on subscriptions you forgot about. Stop wasting your time trying to cancel subscriptions the hard way. Make your life easier and go to rocketmoney.com/cancel. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. Or download the app from the Apple app or Google Play stores.
Man, was the stress pretty high playing a golf course like this when the greens can get this fast?
Oh yeah. It's one of those, like, you never feel like you can kind of take your mind off. You don't have like it's just kind of a straightforward hole. You know, you just hit a driver out there somewhere, hit a middle of the green, and then you either make the putt or you don't. It's like you always have to think. Like it all comes back to the tee. You start looking at the green. Okay, where's the pin? Because the greens are so firm. Mm. So like even like a standard pitching wedge is releasing, I don't know, 15 steps in spots. So like, okay, well, if the pin's on the left, you have to be coming from the right side of the fairway. Okay, how do I get it over there? And then it drags you all the way back to the tee. Like there's a good example. I think hole number 13, it's quite a short hole. You can drive it basically greenside. But if the pin's sitting on the right hand side, like it slopes front to back and it's like a slight dock like left. Mm-hmm. If the pin sits on the right side of the green, the angle, if you hit driver and you're not dead in front of the green or left, you have nothing. Like you can't hit it inside 40, 50 feet. So when the pin's over there, you're late, you hit, I don't know, 6 iron off the tee to give yourself a full wedge. But then when the pin's on the left, then you can be aggressive and hit it up there. So it's just a course that makes you think the whole time and really strategize and hit many different clubs off the tee depending on wind and hole location.
Hey, Charlie, I'm going to bring you in here. And I thought that was a refreshing thing that Rasmus just said, is that angles apparently matter in golf now. They actually do matter. It's refreshing from the bomb and gouge that we potentially see week in and week out.
Yeah, Rasmus, one of my favorite things to do on this show, whether it's with Smiley or another tour pro like yourself, is try to glean as much information about playing the game as I can so I can deliver it to all the, you know, the single digit handicap masses like myself that are trying just to understand how to play the game better. And I thought it was so interesting, both what you're just talking about right there, the strategic approach to the golf course, but also some of the things Cam Smith said earlier in the week about he hasn't had to shape a ball like this and you know, rounds, you know, tournaments even, where just, you know, flighting the ball differently in the wind and different ways you can access pins. And so understand that you are jet lagged, and I don't want to ask too much of you here, but can you think of maybe like a shot or two where this was Rasmus at his best as an artist, and just the process of both what you were trying to do with that shot and how you were kind of talking through that and the way you executed that alongside your caddy?
Well, I think if I go to, it would probably be, it actually might be the, my approach shot into 17 yesterday. So you got, I mean, I think, so I hit a good drive. It's a par five. It's playing slightly downwind. I think I have about 225 yards front, but the pin's all the way in the back, and there's, you know, a bunch of slope on the green and tiers and stuff. And it's like a tiny little tier in that back left corner. And anything that's left of the green runs off and leaves a tricky little pitch, and over the green leaves a tricky pitch. So I think I'm 225 front, and I'm close to 260 to the pin. Slightly downwind. You know, the greens are really firm. And I'm standing there, and I'm like, okay, I can hit a 4-iron. It's probably going to fly 5-10 paces on the green. And it should kind of be good for distance. But I decided to go with a 5-iron instead and then hit a flatter flight to make sure that when it does land, whether it lands just short of the green or just on, it does get that kick, getting, trying to, you know, get it back to the pin. Whereas there's a couple of times out there, this was one instance where, let's say you hit the 4-iron and you spin it up a hair and it lands just short of the green, where it's not quite as firm. It could kind of get stuck there, and then you're left in the front portion of the green, which doesn't sound too bad. But with the way the pin placements are, when you're having a long putt like that over really slopey and fast greens, where it's not just a long putt up there, because then if you go, you know, let's say you have a 70 footer and you're going 6-7 feet past, all of a sudden it starts to run away from you, and you could literally putt it off the green. I mean, there's plenty of hole locations this week where if you got in the wrong spot on the green and you're a little aggressive, like, you could putt it off the green, and it's not like it's just barely off the green. It goes down to a spot where you're more likely to use 4 than you are to use 2 to get it from there. So just kind of there's spots like that where I would probably hit more, I would hit a different kind of shot than I normally would. For me this week, I think honestly the biggest difference was some of the tee balls. I mean, I can't remember I've hit so many fairway woods with as much curve as I had this week, simply just to make the fairways as big as possible. Because that's one thing, when the greens get really, really firm and fast and the greens are slopey, like, you have to play from the fairway to give you any kind of chance to get anywhere remotely close to the pins.
That's super interesting, because a golf course that really comes to mind in the States that maybe requires you to curve, especially with the slopes of the fairways and having to play in the fairway, Olympic Club is like one of the main golf courses that comes to mind that puts a value on shot shape, direction of the hole. So that's interesting, man. I wish we got to see a little bit more golf in the Sand Belt in firm conditions, and we're honestly just getting down to the Sandbound and playing these golf courses that are just incredible. Yeah. I got two more questions on the way out with you, Rasmus. One is, what was going through your brain on the 18th hole? Well, you got the putt now. Of course, Cam Smith has an opportunity to do something as well. Go talk us through that match play scenario that you were kind of dealing with on that 18th green.
Well, so after I've hit my little chip shot, pitch shot, whatever you want to call it, on the green there. I knew he had a really tough two putt, but I mean, he's literally one of the best putters in the world. He's a great putter. He's just made a 20 foot on the last. I'm thinking, foregone conclusion, he's going to two putt this. I have to just go ahead and do my thing and try to make this putt. And I got a pretty good idea of, I know it's going to break a fair bit left to right. I've seen it go through from the other angle. And I see his putt go down to 6 feet. And there's not really that much stuff going on in my mind. I'm literally just thinking about my process. Okay, what's the read? I need to hit here with this speed. and it's like, I'm not thinking, I caught myself. I'm like, you could think about, okay, well, you want to hit this firmer and I'm firmer to make sure you get it there. But I'm like, no, I mean, it's like they're so fast and so much slope. If I start trying to mess with the inches speed that I would read the putt with, I'm going to get the read all wrong anyway. So the best chance I had of making that putt was just to go through my process and not really worry about whatever was going to happen. And then obviously, as I saw it go in, it's just pure emotion coming out. Like, I wouldn't say it's a part of, it's part excitement, part relief. Obviously, you've been battling all day. You got all kinds of things going on in your mind throughout a day like that, playing in the final group. And I've been close a couple of times where I've had a couple chance, where I had some chances to maybe do some. But I'm thinking there, I'm like, okay, I need to make this putt to have any chance. I'm thinking he's going to make the putt coming up. So to make that, I'm thinking, okay, that's for a playoff. And then at that point, after I made it and I was waiting for him to putt, I'm all I can think about is just try and get myself like back down to earth so I can be ready to go play in a playoff. Cause I mean, if you'd asked me right after I made that putt to go teed up again on 18, there's no saying what could have happened.
Have you had it, you know, this entire situation on 18, has it sunk in? Because a lot of times when you make a putt on the last hole and you have that raw emotion, a lot of times it's to win a golf tournament and then you have somebody miss. So it's kind of a weird deal. It's like, you know, you always think about having that putt to get that Masters invite. And here you have somebody missing a putt. Have you had that opportunity to kind of be, to look forward for what you have coming up this coming year now?
Yeah. I obviously had a long flight. So when I wasn't sleeping, I just really looking forward to next year. I got a pretty damn exciting season coming up. Obviously one thing is get to play in the Masters. Also a couple of weeks ago, I got my PGA Tour card through the rankings last year. Just can't wait. Like, Augusta is going to be so special. That's probably, I don't know if it's the first event I watched growing up, but it's the first event I can remember as a kid being like, I want to play that tournament one day. So it's going to be pretty cool to go be able to live that dream in April.
Man, congrats, man. We're super excited for you. We look forward to seeing on the PGA Tour. Are you going to be at Sony?
I'm actually going to play the first two events in Dubai and then start up at Torrey.
All right. Well, I will see you on the West Coast, potentially on the PGA Tour, man. Congratulations to you. I know Charlie's looking forward to watching you. We've seen you. We've been keeping tabs, you know, Charlie. We've been noticing some really good play from this guy, and we're happy to see him break through.
Well, there's a lot of good tape we saw at Oakmont, and then, you know, we'll see Rasmus if I get seated next to Soren again in the Augusta National Press Building. You know, we'll have something to talk about.
I'm sure he's going to be there.
I love it.
All right, Rasmus. Well, congratulations. Get caught up on sleep and enjoy the celebrations because that's a fun one to win. Congratulations.
Thank you so much, guys. Thanks.
Hugely appreciative of Rasmus Nygaard-Petersen taking the time fresh off his win at the Crown Australian Open. And Smiley, just a little additional recap there. I mean, it is, I'll say this, like it was difficult to follow in real time. There's something a little bit different about the hours there where, like, at least with an event in Europe, you can kind of have that morning window where the consequential golf's being played. But the way the time zones work, at least on the East Coast, if you're on the West Coast, you can almost watch the entire, like on a Wednesday, you could watch all of Thursday for the most part before going to bed. Whereas on the East Coast, all the consequential golf feels like it's being played in the late evening, early morning hours. So it's hard to kind of watch that. But the stuff that I did see and the highlights that I watched, the venue was just phenomenal. Like, just had a real firmness to it. And as you discussed with Rasmus, just the way that the everything was shaved right up to the bunkers, it just it's a beautiful, beautiful canvas for golf.
Oh, 1,000%. Next year it's going to Kingston Heath is what I believe I read. So that's pretty cool that the Aussie Open is bouncing around at some incredible venues. And it's first off, thanks for Rasmus for coming on. It was great to just kind of get his perspective on different shots that he was hitting on this golf course that maybe we don't get to see week in, out. And just really, I mean, God, what a high quality player he is, and excited to see what he's going to be able to do on the PGA Tour next year. He's official world golf rankings 51st right now. You mentioned as well that he was you know, very at the top of the leaderboard for quite some time at the US Open. Mm-hmm. So when we look at the DP World Tour and the players that are coming over this year, a lot of exciting names with Marco Pange, and you got Alex Noren, who we talked about earlier today, who's been on the PGA Tour, but still coming from the DP category, I guess you could say. Another one just won at the Nedbank, Reiten,
I think. Christopher Reiten. Norwegian.
There's a lot of good players that are playing really well, and it was awesome to see a guy who's coming to the PGA Tour next year win the Aussie Open in an away game.
described it. Hostile environment. I will say too, this got my wheels spinning just thinking about, you know, we refreshed an old clip from your conversation with Ian Baker Finch about, you know, how do you do golf in Australia? Rory had quotes this week about, you know, there need to be conversations had to find a date that accommodates everyone, and just people seeing the scenes on TV. It's such a compelling product. All right, here's my half-baked idea, my pitch here, right? Is we've talked a lot in golf media spaces the past couple of years about the growth of YouTube golf, right? And the rise of that specific type of product and the way that resonates with a lot of people. But to me, it's like if you look at the Creator Classic and the Internet Invitational, these are two very different products, right? Like the Creator Classic to date is a collection of internet personalities playing golf, but being broadcast in the same fashion as normal tour golf, because you have this obligation to pay off the result and to show action from all these different people playing that contribute to the storyline of like that result, right? Like you can't just focus on one group or one person as you would for the most part for YouTube golf, like a good match or whatever. You're just going to follow those guys around for the entire tournament. For the entire match. So my half-baked idea here is, what about a TV premiere in the United States that is focused on one player or one group? Like what if, you know, and the player would have to be willing to grant this level of access, but how cool would it have been to had a film crew with Rory, you know, on a Thursday or a Friday, and he's mic'd up and he's just narrating throughout the entire round as if he was playing YouTube golf. And so then you've already, you know, anyone who wants to see the live rear, I mean, it's already happened. You go look at the leaderboard, you know what happened, and there'd be space for that as well. But how cool would it be to then have this fresh product that's just a look inside Rory going around? Because I think that connects to our fascination with the venue, like watching Rory think his way around Royal Melbourne and hit certain types of shots and have him tell you what he's doing. Again, it'd be up to the player to provide the access, but that I feel like is a way to combine what you're trying to do with YouTube golf and also justifying the whole time zone difference.
You said it was half-baked idea, or was it fully baked?
What was it? Yeah, it could go in either direction. It can be fully baked, half-baked. I mean, there's something there, Smiley.
I don't know.
Give me some points there.
No. If we're doing the round the horn, I'm going, derk. I'm not buying it. You know why I'm not buying it? Because it's professional golf and YouTube golf, it's just not the same.
Yeah.
And I definitely see the vision that you're putting across of being able to watch these guys play. Like visually the shots that they hit, and then also hearing their commentary. But a lot of times there may not be that commentary, or you'd have to have some post-production of them going in and doing the commentary later. So it just, yes, I would love to watch what you're talking about, but I, from an execution standpoint, I'm like,
You have to cut it live. Like basically what you'd have to do is you have to have like two or three cameras with that player's group and being run back into a production truck and having someone taking sources and live cutting it so that then they have that polished product they could just ship and air right after it. So there wouldn't be as much polish as a true YouTube round. I'm just trying to think creatively. How do you showcase, you know what I'm saying? How do you do something that makes it have unique television value in the States?
I don't think that just extends to something outside of the States. Like, I think this is something that you could do. That's something that you could do in the States with the PGA Tour. They could mic up a guy and they can do some post production of something similar. You know, I think from that standpoint, it's a good idea. I'm hesitant to know exactly like separating golf, like YouTube golf and the personalities and,
yeah,
and just the overall bits versus professional golf. Like that's kind of a big hurdle, but I'm here. I'm somewhat here. Maybe okay. I'm giving you a point.
Ding. All right. You know, okay. All right. Just let it bake a little bit more. Just let it keep baking for Smiley there a little bit. We'll get there eventually. Yeah, well, it was cool to see those visuals on TV. And Smiley, that's
Alistair McKenzie.
Alistair McKenzie.
He mentioned, I think Augusta National and Royal Melbourne have the same course architect.
Cypress Point as well. Yeah. Pasa Tiempo. A lot of good places. A lot of
guys
good places.
Pretty good at his job.
Dr. McKenzie was a medic in the Boer War who learned about camouflage via his participation in that armed conflict. And that's what he took to inspire his designs. This has been Nerding Out on Architecture with Charlie Hume. Thanks for joining.
Okay.
We're getting the fully baked portion of the show.
My goodness.
Yeah. Well, you have to catch a flight, and you've been kind here to, as I mentioned at the top of the show, you and Jackson were great to have a little tribute for my dad at the end of last week's show and also create some space here just to share some memories and just some things that really, it'll be a hole that'll never be filled, but we'll always have lots of wonderful memories with him and the way he impacted our lives. And I just thought in the context of what we're doing here on this show, it'd be fun just to talk a little bit about, I mean, my dad's dad didn't play golf. And he came to golf. He came home from a business meeting where he shot like 1 million and was determined to go play the game of golf. And so he took my dad along with him to figure it out. And so I think there's a lot of cool father-son connections there, the things we talk a lot about here. I remember some of my favorite bedtime stories were as my dad was learning the game in La Jolla, California, he worked at the cart barn. And so there was like a period of like 3 to 6 years to much to my mom's horror where my dad's bedtime stories that he would give to myself, my brother David, was just telling all the pranks he used to do in the cart barn to like this older guy who ran the cart barn. We thought it was the greatest thing in the entire world. So I loved, just the way he exposed us to the game. He devised this entire scoring system called Hume Golf. Where effectively what it meant was that we played these familial matches, but he'd set it up so that no one was ever out of the match. There was like no reason to quit in this match because the scoring would change if you were up by too many holes. When I think about being a son and being a father, I think you don't really know what it means to be a son until you become a father. Mm-hmm. I think that mm-hmm. when I had Walker, my first son, and obviously subsequently Kate, my daughter, that the depth of love that you feel for your children is unlike anything you ever experienced in the entire world. And so then you have this backward reflection of like, that's the way that my dad and my mom feel about me. Mm-hmm. And it's hard to wrap your head around what that is. And I think my dad was just, he had true fatherly joy for all of us. And it was something that probably of all the gifts he gave me, that was the thing that really resonated with me the most. And I now when I try to be a dad to my kids, even though they're not going to have their pop around, and that's the thing that breaks my heart the most really is that, I was lucky to have 37 years of them and that they had 3 and 1 and just the fact that they got robbed of someone who would have been such an amazing grandfather is really the thing that breaks my heart the most. But, even in that time, my job now becomes keeping his memory alive by living out that sort of message of fatherly joy and encouragement and just being there for all those moments, being truly passionate, loving, and supportive of your children at all those things. It's just something that my dad ingrained in me. And I feel really privileged and blessed to be able to have had his example and carry that on. And the last thing I'll leave you with is I thought this was so cool. My brother and I, 2 days after my dad passed, our entire family went out to play the short course of Pebble Beach, Peterhay. And it's called the Hay now. The Tiger Redesign course is the Hay. It used to be called Peterhay when my dad would drop off the two of us or take us out to go play that course when we were too young to play the big courses. And my brother made his first ever hole in one there. He and I were playing together on what was a downhill par 3, the 7th hole at Peterhay. And when Tiger came in and he did the redesign, they changed all the different sort of hole locations and green complexes, but they kept one of them the same. And that hole is what used to be the seventh hole downhill, and then now changes to an uphill is the fourth hole. And so it's like blind shot up the hill. And so we were out there playing. It's David and I and our two sons. And David hits one up the hill, and he said, I think that might be in the hole. And we go up there, and we walk around, and we take our sons up there. And they go looking. Sure enough, it's in the hole. It's the exact same green where I watched David make his first ace. It's the exact same pin location as where that first hole was on the seventh. And I have a picture of my dad and I standing there the last time we played the hay together. And it's the exact same pin when we played it together. And, you know, it's just, I think things like that just lets you know he's still with us.
I mean, that didn't put a tear to your eye, man. It's just like insane. It's such a God thing. And I'll say about your dad too. He was, you know, when Francie and I had an opportunity to meet your folks out in, I guess this was out in California because they hosted us during the Pebble Beach week. And so we went out there and stayed. And I just remember telling Francie leaving that week, I was like, gosh, Charlie's parents could not have been nicer. And even knowing like at the time, like your dad, like already had like a diagnosis and, and I didn't know what to expect. Like, I didn't know if he was, you know, going to be doom and gloom. And like, this guy was living life to the fullest. He was so personable, to Francie and I, and just like genuinely kind and treated us like he was like that we were part of the family. So, when it comes to treating other people, the right way, I think your dad did it better than anybody. Just his personality, how friendly he was with people. And I think he's somebody that I think, like you said, you know, I know he's not going to be here for your kids, but also just his memory, the stories that you can tell, and the example that not only you can set, but that I can set as a father of trying to keep his spirit alive and doing the things that he did really well, which is being really kind and genuine to people and loving the game of golf, which we all do, good and bad on some days. But I think about this too, the event that I you know, if you hadn't had an opportunity to go back and listen to, I guess this was, last year, I think, when you had gone to your trip to Scotland and done your course reviews, it's probably a good listen back, you know, to be able to go on a trip with your dad to play, how many courses did you guys play? You played way too much golf. But at the time, I was thinking, like, at the time, that's what I was thinking. But now looking back, it wasn't enough. Like, you probably could have gone on that trip forever. You know, that's the memories that you're going to have with him from that trip will last a lifetime. And it was on a golf course, right? Like, just
that's a great tee up too, because I there are places that I want to go back with my kids to tell them about their pop up. And there is one, Panmure. I mean, there are a million great places, but Panmure, the logo is a shell. And it's the same sort of representative of this walk, this sort of spiritual walk in Spain, the Camino de Santiago that he went on with my brother David. And so in the wake of this diagnosis at the end here, they sent some stuff that I got made for him and brought to him this last week. And some of his last sort of memories and time with us was in celebration of this love for the game of golf, this sort of spiritual connection, this faith, this amazing faith he had. And just looking at pictures from that week and just remembering, you know, what amazing memory those were, but just what that represents. You know, if you're a dad, if you're a son, you know, those moments will mean a lot to you when you can't have them anymore. And I'm just so, I'll forever just be grateful and blessed to have had those moments with him and to have had his example. So it was a life well lived. And
man. And we'll continue to pray for you as, of course, you're continuing on with the grieving process. I know it's not easy, never easy to lose your dad, but we'll continue to be thinking about you, Charlie. And I know we'll continue to keep his spirit alive, whether it's on the golf course or meeting other people. And just continue to pray for you, your mom, rest of your family. And we love you, man.
The love is mutual, man. I love you. I love Jackson. And I love all the people out there. They're part of this audience and supportive along the way. And we will keep his memory alive that way, because the one picture we looked at that Scotland trip was, we're like, look at this beautiful hole. We were both up there on that hill on the right. We were both out there in the woods. We're going to keep doing a lot of that here on this show. So we're so grateful to all of you and the way you supported us. Great recap with you here, and Smiley, we'll just keep rolling in 26.
You got it.
You know, I listen to this podcast, it's really cool, and
all of our first lovely time fans and subscribers, but make sure you like and subscribe.
It's cool to see what you guys are doing. I know golf fans appreciate it, but we do too, so please keep it up.
For all the good people of YouTube, like and subscribe.
You guys have some good takes, so I'm happy to come on and shoot the